know there's things you cannot tell me. But I also know there's a story here, and I think everybody will hear about it.
Do you think your paper has the resources to take that on?
I do. Do you?
The Boston priests molested kids in 6 different parishes over the last 30 years. The church found out about it and did nothing. We haven't committed any long-term investigative resources to the case.
No, we haven't.
And that's the kind of thing your team would do.
Spotlight.
Guys, listen. Everybody's going to be interested in this.
Obviously, the church will fight us very hard.
Trying to get some background information.
I don't want you recording this in any way, shape, or form. Nothing.
We understand you've settled several cases against the church.
I can't discuss that.
There aren't any records of any of these settlements.
Nope.
When you're a poor kid from a poor family, and when a priest pays attention to you, it's a big deal. How do you say no to God?
Spotlight.
Just the tip line.
You think he's got something?
I want to keep digging.
We need to focus on the institution. Show me that it came from the top down.
Try to silence anyone who speaks out.
You leave me alone, you hear me, goddammit?
6% act out sexually.
6% is 90.
90 priests.
If there were 90 of these bastards, people would know.
Maybe they do.
Dear God, you're going to give me the names and the names of their victims.
Are you threatening me?
I was doing my job.
Yeah, you and everyone else.
I am here because I care. We're going to tell this story. We're going to tell it right.
Hoping we can keep this between us until we all get on the same page.
Is that why we're here, to get on the same page?
We've got two stories here. A story about degenerate clergy, and a story about a bunch of lawyers turning child abuse into a cottage industry. Which story do you want us to write? Because we're writing one of them.
I'm not crazy.
They control everything.
This is not just Boston. It's a whole country. It's a whole world.
They knew! Let it happen! It could have been you! It could have been me! It could have been any of us!
Shining a spotlight on all the president's men and broadcasting the news up close and personal, this is Box Office Bylines, a podcast about movies, about journalism, that used to be a radio show. The headlines, the deadlines, the insiders, the train wrecks, the papers, the posts, and the proxies. Hudsucker, that is. I am Jacob Boone in Yellowknife, Northwest Territories, Canada, editor, journalist, sometimes writer, former Haligonian, joined, as always, by my co-host, dear friend, fellow editor, fellow former co-worker.
Current Haligonian.
Current Jared Haligonian. Thorne. Multi-hyphenate, author, filmmaker,
yep.
Columnist, musician, band leader.
Professional poor person. TT.
Tara Thorne, host of The Tideline.
Yes. Christmas finally came. I don't know if you planned it this way, but you, every time I suggested we do this movie, you wouldn't let me do it. You wouldn't let us do it.
Well, I wanted to hold off for something special. And
okay.
Tis the season.
Mm-hmm.
Finale.
30 weeks.
30 yeah. weeks we have gone, give or take, 30 episodes over the course of, what, 34 weeks maybe?
Yeah, maybe.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah, since March, April, I don't know.
Yeah, and we're going to take a break for a little while. I don't think we're going to stop fully, but we have other things coming up in the new year, so we need to put this aside for a little bit. We'll get into that later.
Yeah.
Right now, Tara.
Yes.
For right now.
Yes.
Let's talk about Spotlight.
Spotlight.
2015.
Mm-hmm.
Directed by Tom McCarthy, who played a journalist in The Wire.
Mm-hmm.
Written by Josh Singer, who also wrote The Post and The Fifth Estate, that movie where Benedict Cumberbatch plays Julian Assange.
Yes, that one is recommended to us often, and we didn't get to it in season one.
It's not that good.
Also, I want to say that Josh Singer co-wrote The Post because
oh, yes.
the lady screenwriter was her first produced screenplay.
He also co-wrote this with McCarthy, I should mention.
There you go.
He's a real good journalism movie
journalist
co-writer.
Punch up. Yeah. What a job. I hope I can get that job someday.
Starring a veritable Marvel's Studios Avengers of Journalism Movie Actors from Zodiac and 13 Going on 30, Mr. Mark Ruffalo.
The Hulk himself.
From The Paper, Michael Keaton.
The Birdman.
From Morning Glory and The Notebook, a movie about writing, I believe.
Sure. Yeah, never saw that's it. What it is.
Rachel McAdams.
Yes. Hashtag
from
Canada.
Scream and Scream 2, Liev Schreiber.
Yep.
From The Devil Wears Prada, Stanley Tucci. And from Almost Famous, Billy Crudup, our first film we watched.
Wow.
Also, Brian D'Arcy James and John Slattery. But they weren't in any journalism movies.
I'm actually surprised John Slattery wasn't in anything that we watched.
So am I. I thought he did show up somewhere along the way, but...
And he is a good... I mean, he does play that in this movie, but he is a good, like, veteran whatever.
Newsroom type.
With the silver hair and all. Yeah.
I'm going to be biased in this. I'm going to be biased loving this movie.
Mm-hmm. Same.
Because of the circumstances how you and I saw this film.
Okay. We're going to talk about that?
Why don't we talk about that? Why don't we get into that? So this 2015, so that would have been... My second year full-time at the Coast?
Can I just butt in to interrupt and remind you that I had seen this at TIFF?
I didn't know that. So you had already watched it. I didn't know that.
I had already seen it, yeah. And I actually, when I had seen The Post in New York City, ever heard of it, at Christmas. So, you know, because things get to Halifax late. That's more of a commentary on
that's not
movie
not.
Releases.
No, it's not late. It opened in Halifax the same time it opened everywhere nationally. You just had special... No, Tara. TIFF is not...
No, the Post...
Standard.
Oh, yeah, no, TIFF is different. TIFF is different, yeah. But yeah. The Post, that was a New York, LA Oscar qualifying run type of deal.
Gotcha, okay.
So I just want to say that because being on time is very important to me, but it might not have been as fervent this time because I had already seen it. Okay, but go ahead.
So we decided to see this as a newsroom. I don't know whose idea that was. but the entire Coast newsroom of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Too many people for a regular car.
Six people. Got into our editor's... What kind of car is that? Crossover?
I don't know.
SUV of some kind?
Some
it only
sort
seats
of thing.
Five.
Correct.
So... Illegally, our colleague Allison.
Yep.
Got into the trunk.
Yep.
And Allison's very tall. She probably was the last person who should have been curled up like that in the trunk.
Definitely. And also, I want to say for two reasons. One, car share wasn't a thing yet.
Right. None of us had cars.
Two, cabs are very expensive out there. And three, no one else could afford a car because they worked at the Coast.
And we drove out. To get dinner first.
Yeah.
At Harvey's.
Every news person's favorite haunt.
A great Canadian burger joint.
I like a Harvey's. They used the charcoal grill.
And I remember how, because I drank the most coffee at the Coast.
Mm-hmm. Constant.
But also I would end up buying it for that reason because, like, I couldn't wait for the small bag of like farmer's market, whatever coffee that would be brought in. I would like, it was a quantity issue over quality.
Yeah.
So I would often get like one of the big tins of Maxwell House or something.
Folgers.
From down at Joe's at the convenience store. And I remember our former colleague Grant mentioning that they were on sale at Walmart in Bears Lake. And I was like, well, I got to, again, we're not making a lot of money. So this is a way to say I didn't get reimbursed for these. So, okay. I was like, can you guys drop me at Walmart so I can grab a couple tins of coffee? I'll meet you at Harvey's. And I foolishly thought you would all wait maybe to order. Maybe. I don't know. I got the coffee and I walked over and everyone was already like done eating.
Eating
almost.
Probably.
And so I didn't want to like, and we were late for the movie and you were adamant like we have to be there. And so
I was adamant.
Like, okay.
Yeah, that sounds right. But that's the other thing. Like this group of people could not be on time to their own fucking funeral.
Yeah.
So the idea that our boss, who's the latest person I've ever met in my life, was in control of getting us as a group to the place, and there was dinner on top of it. It was too many things.
It was a lot of variables. I was very hungry, and Kyle, thankfully, he did buy me some popcorn.
You were so mad.
I like a Harvey's. It had been forever since I existed.
And Walmart is like open till midnight. I don't know why we couldn't have just stopped on the way out, but that's the way we did it.
Anyway,
it's done now.
So we got in and we watched the movie, and it was a lot of fun, and there were a lot of in-jokes and references, and I feel like we all talked about it the whole way home with this like invigorated investigative spirit.
Yeah.
And so there's this personal connection, I find. We repeated this the next year with The Post, but it wasn't the same.
Well, it wasn't as good. It wasn't as good.
Wasn't as good a movie. It wasn't as good a time.
And I do remember Spotlight being quite full, which was exciting.
Yeah.
Yes. And we all got to sit in a row, despite our extreme lateness. Yeah.
It was a weird, like, journalist going to see a journalism movie late on like a Friday with popcorn. Like, it felt not juvenile, but there was a fun sense of adventure and having an exciting time out with friends, even if they were coworkers and bosses, when we're going to see a very serious movie.
Yes, but I mean, there aren't that many journalism movies, and there definitely aren't ones, I mean, you've heard 29 previous episodes. There aren't ones that are as, you know, beloved and as good as this. So that was extra exciting. It wasn't like, let's just go to a journalism movie. It's like, no, we're going to the journalism movie.
And none of us knew that. I mean,
I did. I'd already seen it.
Yeah, I mean, but like, I knew it was good, but I didn't know it would resonate the way it did. And that it would win, like, Best Picture and get all these awards and stuff, you know. And kind of come down with, like, All the President's Men and, I don't know. Well, like, it's got to be up there in the top two or three journalism movies of all time.
For sure.
I know it's recent, but, like, it earns its place there.
By the way, I have an Oscar party every year. And, as you know, Best Picture gets handed out quite late. And people generally don't make it to the end of the Oscar party. So down to the wire was me and Allison. And I think another Allison who she lived with, who was a journalist, and then possibly a fourth person. And just before 1 a.m., they were like, Spotlight. And we screamed. Like, the house had been quiet for 2 hours. And we screamed so loud that I left a apology plant at my downstairs neighbor's door the next day, because aww. I was like, there's no way you didn't wake up when we screamed about Spotlight winning Best Picture.
I love that. That's so great.
It felt like we got to, yeah. It felt good. Like, it's just like, you know, journalism as an industry takes a lot of shit. It's been decimated from the inside out. And it was like, no, here's some people doing their job, and they made change, and it was worldwide, and it was huge, and here's this movie that didn't fuck any of it up. It was so exciting.
Yeah. It felt like we won for a day or two.
Yeah.
Yeah, why don't we, let's talk about
it. Get into it.
All that background. I don't think we need to recount the plot for anybody. It's pretty recent. I'm sure folks have seen it.
We could say a line. It's sure. Like an investigation into the Catholic abuse in the Catholic Church. You know, that old thing.
Boston, 2000. I really, one of the things I love about this movie is it's about how we miss stories. There's that line about how, you know, in the profession we're stumbling around in the dark. And there's also reference to, like, how everyone else in town already knows about this. And, you know, it takes a village to abuse a child. All that stuff. And the ultimate sort of comeuppance, not really. But there's definitely villains here. But what we learn at the very end in one of the last scenes is that Michael Keaton's editor character, who we've been, you know, has been sort of our crusading hero this whole time, is the one who shelved the scoop about all these priests 20 years ago when a survivor sent him all the details and the lawyer sent him all the names, and he was just young and new to his position as city editor and didn't know what to do with it and missed it.
Yeah, and like, it's no small thing to take on the Catholic Church at all, but then like the Catholic Church in Boston, this is something that's hammered over and over in the movie. Like, this is like, Catholicism is a huge part of a certain sect of Boston culture. Mm-hmm. So it's like, the reason the priests were able to get away with everything is because they were considered the pillars of the community. So yeah. A young editor, even if you're like a hotshot and you want to break some sort of story, that's not the one that you're going to go after.
I think with All the President's Men and some other films, it presents that sort of idea that if there's a big enough story, we'll find it. We'll come across it. And it takes maybe a good journalist to really get it out there. But the fundamental principles of the industry work, you know? Mm-hmm. Truth will
rises
out
to the top. Like cream, I don't know.
And I think this does a really interesting job of saying, like, it takes time and people caring, and it takes the right circumstances at the right time, maybe. You have to go with the story you have. Like, I mean, you can't really, I guess, beat yourself up too much if you didn't get to it yesterday. You just try to get to it today. I don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, I know. It's like,
it's not self-congratulatory in that way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't stand up. It definitely does a good job of talking about how important journalism is, but it doesn't pat itself on the back or make these guys out to be virtuous heroes the way some films would. They're just human beings, and they're just trying to do what they think is right in the moment.
Yeah, and I mean, and we're with them when they're breaking the original couple stories, where, and then there's a title card that says they published 600 things.
You know, so in it's a year.
Yeah, so it's also like what we talked about last week, where the guy on the talk show asked the journalist Tollenton, like, what's your goal here? And he's like, there's no goal. Like, we're working.
Yeah.
It's just like a constant, you know, move forward and just tackling things as they come and running them down, and there's no end and there's no party and there's no, I mean, you might get a Pulitzer, but that doesn't mean you stop doing what you do. You didn't win, I guess is what I'm saying. Can we talk about how the journalists look? Because I thought it's the most accurate I've ever
seen. Absolutely, absolutely.
Ruffy, who is a very attractive man, has just an awful haircut. Uh-huh. And they, at one point, they go to his apartment, and one of his coworkers goes to his apartment. He's like, how long are you going to be in this shithole? And it implies that he's like separated from his wife. And they're good with that sort of stuff. It's sort of like a cop procedural in that way, where it's like, it's about the work, but they push in enough of the personal details of their home lives that you're like, oh, this is a well-rounded person.
Slattery as Ben Bradley Jr., I don't think combs his hair the entire movie. or it has that look of someone who's run their hands through it in exhaustion.
Yeah.
Once or twice. Rachel McAdams, like, none of her clothes are ironed.
Oh, and the wide leg khakis.
Because, like, and that, it rings so fucking true, because, like, you have to dress kind of professional, but you're also overworked and sitting at a desk. And so all of your clothes are comfortable, professional, but usually it's like the second day you've worn them.
Well, I'm an arts reporter, so I've never had to be professional. Okay. But I get it.
Yeah.
And yeah, she's like, you're going to people's houses.
And
you're
no one has the money,
houses.
Right?
Yeah.
No one has the money for like a fresh His Girl Friday type outfit and hat every day.
I do remember from that screening, there's a scene where Ruffalo's making a coffee and he pours the milk in, and Allison leaned over and goes, was that just sitting out?
Yeah.
And I found that to be a very accurate detail. Like, there was no fridge around. It was just like, here's the coffee.
There's
here's
the coffee,
the milk.
There's milk. Can I rattle through some other things I love?
Yes.
The opening sad work party with cake.
And they carried it back to their desk.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Because that's like dinner, you know, or lunch. The score, which is great. And sometimes I still like write too.
Oh, wow.
How fast everyone walks.
Mm-hmm.
especially when they have somewhere to go or somewhere to be, and they start doing a little fun speed walk.
Ruffalo full on runs in some scenes.
He does full on run. Courthouse bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Like getting the docket or whatever, but then also the copier room is closed, so you're trying to negotiate photocopies elsewhere. I've been in those situations.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever bribed anyone?
No. Oh, did I? No, not technically. I have. I remember because this was, I think, one of the last things I did work on for the coast or something. I had to get something photocopied, and the photocopier was down or something, and so I asked if I could, one of the clerks, like, could you guys photocopy this for me? And they're like, we'll still have to charge you. And I'm like, that's fine. And it, I don't know, 10 cents a page, it worked out to, I think, like $4 or something. And they said, we'll leave it on the security desk. And they left it there. And I went, and the security desk was like, here you go. And I was like, okay, how do I pay? And he's like, I don't think you have to. And I was like, okay. And I just left because I think I had zero in my bank account anyways at that moment. So I probably owe the law courts of Halifax $4 in photocopy charges. That's not a bribe, but there you go.
Mm-hmm.
The door knocking scenes.
Ugh. Especially when she finds a guy who's like, yeah, I abuse people.
Yeah.
Because I also was abused. And then she gets cut off at the knees by his sister.
Oh, yeah. The fact that, like, some people invite you in and, like, give you coffee and some people are, like, yelling at you and you have to, like, walk away politely because they're going to beat you up. Like, I thought it was nice that all of that was included.
Yeah, like, when there's, like, a guy, on a scaffold, like, yelling at one of the men. He's like, get out of here. Kick your ass.
All of the sad meals. Mark Ruffalo boiling hot dogs.
Like, here, and then he, like, gets a gift of... Leftover pizza.
Shitty looking pizza, yeah. The sad apartments as well, as we mentioned.
Very
like
brown.
He's in like a basement. The like heater is like on the ceiling for some reason. when Ruffalo gets the documents and he's so excited that he like jumps in the cab, tells the cab driver where to go because he used to be a cab driver, and then calls the newsroom to excitedly report everything he found. That was fun. Yeah. Rachel McAdams' husband. Her schlubby, supportive husband, Hansi, who doesn't, like, say you're working too hard or anything. He just helps her do the dishes and has very little other,
it's the girl part.
Action to play. Yeah, it is.
It's the wife part. Yeah.
But even then, like, it's not the nagging or, it's not the nagging part that we've seen in a lot of other movies either.
Mm-hmm.
Rachel McAdams' grandmom.
Oh, who she knows she's going to ruin her life with this story.
Yeah, that those scenes are hard.
Mm-hmm.
Rachel McAdams herself.
Yeah.
Who does an incredible job.
Have you seen, there is a piece that came out that was basically like, why was Sasha Pfeiffer so sidelined in Spotlight? It's the one piece of criticism I've seen.
Huh, okay.
Yeah. Maybe why we'll put that on our reading list. But it was basically like, She could have been more. I mean, I don't know. I think it's pretty well spread amongst the ensemble.
Yeah.
With Ruffalo leading.
It's with save the fourth guy, Brian D'Arcy James.
Oh yeah. Who,
but I think they do a pretty good job.
Yeah.
Of spreading it out. I really enjoy. I don't know if the real Sasha Pfeiffer is like this. I imagine. But the way McAdams delivers her lines, where she's she talks fast. And it's sort of almost clipped, like she gets right to the point, but it's also very sensitive.
Mm.
And I think I've met journalists who talk like that, who the things they're saying, they've thought about, they don't waste words like I'm doing right now. But that doesn't mean they're, you know, inhuman or unsensitive. They're extremely empathetic with other
human
beings.
Yeah, it's an efficiency thing.
Yeah. I thought that rang very true. The same with Ruffalo, where he, like, asks his questions in sort of a probing way, but he doesn't give things away.
Mm-hmm.
This sort of more impish puck sort of way, which I'm more familiar with
right.
In terms of getting people to talk.
Rachel has that scene where she meets the gay guy who in the diner and immediately like spills coffee on herself, which I found very relatable. And and then they kind of, you know, like they go for a walk and they just sort of talk out in the open, and it, and yeah, she gets all the hardest victims. Sorry, survivors. And I think, I don't know if that's like a woman thing. I often think when I, you know, I'm a big Law and Order person, and I've often thought, why would they send in Ice-T for this girl who has been attacked? And I think it's sort of a similar approach where it's like, send the woman in because, you know, men aren't going to want to talk to other men about being assaulted by men.
Well, it's interesting because, and you talk about her being sidelined, because when they start this process of who they're, how they're going to divide the work up, which I don't know if the real, I'm sure the real Spotlight team did do this. It's also a very useful, practical filmmaking tool to have people looking into different aspects. So Ruffalo takes Stanley Tucci, the lawyer, and Rachel McAdams works with the victims. So we're able to kind of go through the, and Ruffalo, like McAdams says she had, she seems to be the most experienced, like, court reporter. But she had, like, past experience working with Garibedi and the Stanley Tucci's character, and I guess he didn't like her, and so Ruffalo decides to take it.
Right.
So there is the implication she's just as capable, but having someone new would be maybe better. There's also, when we see her go to the courthouse in one scene, the clerk that's very annoyed with Mark Ruffalo seems very friendly and professional with Rachel McAdams, which I thought was nice, where it's like, it's sort of the way Mark Ruffalo's character rubs people.
Yeah, he's not, people don't like
gives
him.
Gives him some difficulty.
Yeah, they don't like him. He's got a squirrely energy. His haircut's terrible.
Uh-huh.
And he's coming at you. And it's interesting. What did you think of, so they're like getting down to the wire. It's Christmas time. Hashtag Christmas movie. And they just sort of throw away. And Resendez needs time to write the story. So the whole time, Ruffalo's going to be the writer. And I wish they had, maybe there's a cut scene of them like fighting over who writes it or whatever.
Because I feel like the original story, it was it just like sort of byline Spotlight. Or maybe it's like, because something like this, you wouldn't just have one story. You would probably have multiple stories under a pack. And maybe it was, that could have maybe used a montage of everyone writing something.
Everyone typing, please. Dear Tom McCarthy.
But I will say probably better to have one person write.
And have everyone else contribute. Draft,
and then everyone else can contribute later, because otherwise it can get bad.
Yeah, I just feel like there would have been a fight, like there would have been a discussion about who writes it and why, and I would have liked to have seen that. But maybe it exists and it just got cut.
Yeah. What else? The line about how nobody reads the Phoenix.
Oh, the Alt Weekly. I love the Boston Phoenix. It was snarky. It was huge too.
The inspiration for Between the Lines.
So, and they don't. Yeah, it's so mean. I think it died not long after. No, I mean our movie's set far back, but the Boston Phoenix doesn't exist anymore.
But you know what? Like, picture us as the coast watching that.
Yeah.
And the big, powerful newspaper, the newspaper that when they're talking about all the cutbacks, they still not only have their own building, but have multiple floors within that building.
Yeah, they have their own office. It's in the basement, but it's theirs.
Yeah. And this lawyer is like, oh, did you read the article in the Phoenix? And he's like, I thought it was very good. And it's like, yeah, that's us. We get to the story first. And then Ruffalo's like, nobody reads this. Talk to us. We're the big paper that people actually read. It's like, okay, yeah. Going to the office on weekends. Very familiar.
Yeah, for you especially. You didn't have to jog there, though, because you lived really close. We all did.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Sophia's Coffee Shop.
Yeah. I wish we had one of those. There were many days.
Like in-house cafe.
Yeah. That was clearly just an unused room.
Yeah.
They're like, we'll put a hot pot
here. It wasn't like
one
of those like lobby like coffee carts. It was a storage room with a pizza turning thing.
Yeah, and like a hot plate.
I worked somewhere once. It was for Transcontinental. They had some weekly papers. in Halifax. I ended up getting sold to the Herald, and then I got laid off. But they had a snack room downstairs. It was like sort of where the coffee was, but they also had a whole bunch of, I don't know, mini bags of chips or those like tuna and cracker meals and things in the fridge as well. And a menu of prices. And so if you took something, you would just put the amount in or an IOU, which would be collected at the end of the month. And I always thought that was a nice system, especially if it was the weekend and I didn't, I had a car, but, you know, nothing's in walking distance in Bears Lake if I wanted to just go get a coffee and have a chocolate bar with it. So I could get one from the snack room.
Oh, yeah, that would have been.
It was a good system.
That would have been good.
And I appreciated it for the workers there. And I've never seen it replicated anywhere else. I still buy my own coffee.
CBC in the old days had a full-on cafeteria in the old building that's now the YMCA. And now they don't have that. They have multiple kitchens in the new building, but no one works in them. It's like...
Everyone has to... Yeah. You have to make your own.
Yeah, and then there's like there's signs about microwaving fish, i.e. don't do it.
That's what this is missing, a scene in a break room with a passive-aggressive kitchen note taped to the wall. Something else that rang familiar, dead rats in the boiler room.
Oh, my God. What's that smell? There's a dead rat in the corner. We have literally lived through this. Like, we had a room called the rat room.
We had a rat room.
That's
and we were lucky if the rats stayed in that room.
Do you remember there was one year there was a mouse on a pipe, like above a door. I don't know how it got up there.
And we thought it was very cute and he was scared.
No.
Because he was just perched there like a dormouse in a Christmas story. And then we realized he
was quite drugged. Yeah.
He was just
poisoned.
Frozen in rigor mortis. God. We had to flick him off.
I believe he was flushed, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
You couldn't throw him out into the street because, like, a pet eat it and get poisoned.
Oh, okay.
I know.
I had to call 311 once on a dead rat outside our building. It was just in the middle of the sidewalk, this giant dead rat. And it's like, well, who handles this?
The office before this one, which was across from the marquee, there was one week where... pigeons kept piling up in the corner, like not in the building, but just like right before you would turn the corner to walk into the office, there was a pile of pigeons. It was very fucked.
That is weird.
I know, it wasn't cool. North End.
Ha. 9/11 shows up in Spotlight as like a minor plot point.
Well, I mean, yeah, it delays everything, which I thought was, they could have, you know, they could have gone on without ever mentioning it, but I'm glad they did because, you know, Boston was involved in all of that and they all got, you know, sort of reassigned to 9/11 stories to the point where Ruffalo's in Florida and they're like, no, they're about to make these documents public. And he's like, my documents. And he's like, and he thought other papers would get on the story, but then they end up not doing it because they were all focused on 9/11 and they weren't working on this.
Yeah.
So, that reminded me of you when he was like,
my documents.
Well, they'll become public and then anyone could do it. It's like, yeah, but they're not going to think of it, Jacob. I mean, Mark. I mean, whatever your name is, Mike.
Mike. I liked the scene where they're all quietly in Liev Schreiber's office reading through the draft with their red pens.
Mm-hmm.
And he circles something, and John Slattery's like, what? And he just says another adjective.
Oh, yeah. Now, we didn't mention that Liev Schreiber's playing Marty Baron.
Yes, he is.
A very famous journalist.
A very famous.
A baroness von Sketch. I don't know. And yeah, Ben Bradley Jr. So these are, there's all the President's Men sort of DNA in this.
Yeah.
Kind of.
The editing.
Yeah.
I thought I appreciated here on this watch. I've probably seen this four or five times. But cross-cutting between the two victim interviews in the lawyer's office and Sasha and the guy walking around. How there's always churches in the background. I guess that's sort of cinematography and stuff too. But also when they show the different divergent Sunday routines of who's going to church, who's just having brunch, who's running to the office to do more work. when Michael Keaton is at the fancy dinner for the hoi polloi in Boston, and Mark Ruffalo and Stanley Tucci are having like sad soup in a bar, it looks like. That was all very good. I thought it exposed like the idea of like the two different cities and who's aware of things and who's not.
Yeah.
It was nice. Also, probably definitively the most exhilarating research montage in film history.
If you must rank them.
If there's another Excel spreadsheet montage in cinema that is more exciting than this one, I want to know about it.
When they check all the names and check off all the priests and stuff? Yeah.
That's some journalism.
And what did you think of
crack right there?
What did you think of Keaton going to the lawyer's house on Christmas Eve? I don't think it's Christmas Eve exactly, but it's very close. Mm-hmm. And he's got a list of priests. It's like 97 priests, I think they landed on.
87.
He's like, yeah, I need you to tell me. Can you just tell me if these names are right? And he gets really mad. And they circle them all.
Tells him to leave. And like is like, why didn't you cover this? And he's like, I don't know. That I like that. Again, there was no convincing speech that like showed this guy the error of his ways. It was just a like human to human, like we all were a part of this. I was too, because I didn't find a way to cover it. Can we just try now for the victims and the people that this happened to? And that sort of rings true, rather than shaming this guy into it. It's just sort of, I don't know. I like that scene.
I mean, and you're seeing that with a ton of sexual assault coverage now. It's like, why didn't, it's usually she, it's like, why didn't she mention this X years ago? And it's like, well, because reasons. It's hard. It's like a hard thing to cover. And like, the way sexual assault, now we're talking about institutions, and that's something that, you know, Marty Baron says a lot. He's like, we're not going after people, we're going after the institution. But the institution is also just the patriarchy and all of the ways that, you know, that people are kept silent, and the people at newspapers were complicit in that, actively or not. But now we're like, not. It's like, okay, right. Yeah, we need to tell people stories. We need to dismantle our institutions, no matter how hard it is and how much work it is and how much shit we're gonna take. It is fair to say, why not before? But also the answer is, you know, at least it happened, I guess.
What did you think along those lines? There was some comments, controversy maybe, when the film came out about the lawyer played by Billy Crudup, who the real lawyer had this very long Facebook post I remember reading, talking about how, like, you know, he saw it, it's a great movie. He understands that they need to have a villain, that's how movies work, and that's fine. But he, you know, he wasn't ever trying to, like, profit off victims or make, like, a cottage industry. He was doing the best he could. And I felt the lawyer didn't understand. Or, like, he was maybe being unfair to himself, because I think the movie does a good job of setting the sleek TV lawyer up as the potential villain before we realize
he tried to
that
help.
He did try to help.
Yeah.
He did try to go to the press. The press did nothing, so he did the only thing he could for the clients and victims he had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe capitulated a little bit as it went along. But I thought, I don't know, maybe that like misdirection or that like switch isn't so obvious unless you're really paying attention. But do you, I don't know, I was curious on your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, listen, my best friend's a lawyer. She's married to a lawyer. This comes up a lot in my daily life where it's like, not my daily life, but it's come up a lot where it's, you know, they are just, they're doing a job. This is the job they signed up for. But they're, I think with like defense lawyers or, you know, these sort of the guys, the lawsuit guys, like there's also self-interest. Like you're not like, no, I just happen to become the church molestation guy. Like, no, it has to be active. It has to be, it's something you're doing because you know you're going after a place that can afford to pay out and will pay you to keep it silent. So that means they'll pay more. So yes, he tried to help, but it was also in his own self-interest. So I don't know. I don't know if you can begrudge people that or not. Because he did profit, extensively off of, survivorhood.
Oh, a lot is made of the visual difference between his glass office high above.
And Tucci.
The city and Tucci's pile of research papers all around him and files. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah, it's sort of this, yeah. It's like newspapers too. It's like there's a difference between Marty Baron and Mike Resendez. And we see it visually. And the pay scale is quite different as well. So, I don't know. But Marty Baron can at least say, well, I'm always trying to do better. But
okay. Another element I liked is along those lines, there's very little drama within the operation of the paper itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like Baron decides like, hey, can we look into the church? And they're all like, sure. And then he goes to the publisher and he's like, hey, can we sue the church? And the publisher's like, are you sure you want to do that? And he's like, yes. And he's like, okay. And there's no like top down, like even in All the President's Men, we get scenes of them doubting these two reporters.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the only thing is Bradley Jr., Slattery, kind of doing that. But his character feels more, it's based around like being defensive of his staff. And wanting, like, top management not interfere with those operations.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It doesn't, there's no conflict within the paper, which is nice. It's just a very functional news team.
And it is functional, but you have to imagine there were conversations that maybe the movie, because of the way everything happened, like, well, we don't need to see that garbage. Like, we can put, like, they're mad about ads or whatever. Like, we don't need to think about that because we know it happened and we can just show the reporters working as opposed to.
There was a 3-hour shouting match about a headline.
Definitely.
Or like, someone slammed a door or threw a piece of cake. Over whether to use the word cab or taxi.
Yeah. Priest or reverend.
Yeah. Those normal things that occur in a newspaper. I could go on, but we should probably take a break.
Okay. Sounds good. Is there trivia on this? Are people...
Tara, you know there is.
All right.
Guys, I'm really sorry. I don't have any time to talk right now, but if you call my assistant...
We have reason to believe that there are allegations against as many as 87 priests in Boston.
I can't talk to you about that.
Does that number sound right to you?
You gotta be kidding me. I just told you I don't have time for this crap right now.
Eric, how many priests did you settle?
Robbie, you know I can't tell you that.
You're going to give me the names and the names of their victims.
Are you threatening me?
We've got two stories here. We've got a story about degenerate clergy, and we've got a story about a bunch of lawyers turning child abuse into a cottage industry. Now, which story do you want us to write? Because we're writing one of them.
I already sent you a list of names.
What are you talking about? To whom?
The Globe. Years ago. After the Porter case, I got plenty of calls. I had 20 priests in Boston alone, but I couldn't go after them without the press. So I sent you guys a list of names, and you buried it.
I want those names tomorrow.
Check your goddamn clips, Robbie.
And welcome back to the season one finale of Box Office Bylines, where we're finally talking about the gold standard of journalism films, Spotlight. Jacob, hit me with that trivia.
Well, Tara, director Tom McCarthy, I'm sure you know this, but he cited multiple films as an influence on this project, some of which we have seen, some of which we haven't yet, including Frost Nixon, 2008.
Uh-huh.
Broadcast News.
Oh, yeah.
Our beloved Broadcast News. Network, not as much.
Not so beloved. Suck it, Patty.
All the President's Men.
Mm-hmm.
The Killing Fields, we didn't watch, and The Insider, we also didn't watch. Oh, also, Citizen Kane by Mank himself. Ace in the Hole.
Yeah.
JFK, The Verdict, and Good Night and Good Luck, in which McCarthy had a small role.
That's a good movie. JFK is a funny one because that's Oliver Stone. And that was, yeah, like, that would have been like, what not to do?
I'm sure they sometimes watch movies to be like, we're not going to do this.
Let's just like apply some conspiracy theories to our story and see how that plays out.
During an interview on National Public Radio's Fresh Air, director Tom McCarthy said that they built a large set to depict many of the Boston Globe offices where parts of the story take place. When the reporters depicted in the movie first visited the set, they gravitated to their own desks, and many of them started to arrange the items on those desks the way they had been at the time.
Wow. I guess you can't really shoot a movie in a daily newspaper office. I know some people have in the things that we've talked about, but it's not really great. Also, people probably used to go home at night in the old days, but now the online team's in there at night.
What's interesting is so many of the movies we've talked about have spent an incredible amount of time trying to get the office and the desks just right.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the films themselves, like The Mean Season, are not that good. And it does not, that's not a necessary thing. Do you think if you walked onto a set of the Coast office from 2015, you could arrange the items on your desk as they were at the time?
Probably. Just piles of crap and my water bucket and my dusty phone. Yeah, I think I could. How about you?
Yeah, I think I could figure that out pretty easily. Because it would feel wrong. Something would be in the wrong spot and it's like, wait, that's not right. Because you end up, I think, arranging your desk based not on like what you want, but how you tend to use it. And so, I don't know. I think I could. That's a fun challenge. That would be a journalism game show.
Yeah, that'd be great.
In the baseball game scene, the real Michael Resendiz, Sasha Pfeiffer, and Walter Robinson can be seen in the background.
Oh, I love that for them. That's awesome.
Yeah. Also, I think that's nice because that was shot at a real Red Sox game, I think, during like the breaks in the play or whatever. So all the extras could just enjoy a baseball game. They didn't have to like pretend to be doing stuff for a whole day. When Michael Keaton accepted the role, he tracked the real Walter Robinson down before meeting him and found out that he actually lived near Robinson's house. He also had gotten a hold of video and audio of Robinson. And so when they met, he did an impression of him that was so impressive. Robinson was scared and said to him, "How did you know everything about me? We just met."
I would not want to see someone's impression of me. I would not like it.
I would love to see Michael Keaton's impression of me or anyone.
Stephanie Johns does impressions of us sometimes, and they're not that kind.
During every break, Mark Ruffalo asked the real Michael Resendiz to say his lines for him.
Oh.
He also asked if he could listen to him yell at someone. There you go. Small detail, but a lovely one. All the journalists in the film use blue pens. Their bosses use black pens, and Baron uses a red pen.
Nice.
This is a small... That just reminded me that sometime over the summer, I was running out of my red Sharpie. Was running out of ink, and so I ordered a multicolored, like 30 different multicolored Sharpies from Amazon for editing proofing pages. And we had an intern who was with us just recently, and she tended to do proofing with a pencil, I guess under the idea that maybe you could erase, I don't know, but it would blend into the page. And so we gave her a card and some other gifts, but also as a parting gift, I was like, can you choose one of these colored Sharpies, please, and use it for proofing so that I don't miss when you like put a comma in that's missing, and then I can't see it later.
Also, we did not have any kind of system like that, and Kyle always used to chew on the end of his pens. Do you remember that? So you like couldn't use... You couldn't.
I remember
his...
not lending Kyle any of my pens. Yeah. Yes. The Boston Globe was very helpful with the set and approved the costume design, production design, actors, actresses, and script. The Boston Globe approved the actors and actresses? That's weird. All right. Marty Baron says the copy of the catechism used in the film is the very same one he was given to by the real Cardinal Law.
Wow.
Yeah. Margot Robbie from Bombshell turned down the role of Sasha Pfeiffer due to exhaustion.
From, like, being horny in The Wolf of Wall Street?
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe she was just tired, didn't want to do it.
You know, when people are, I usually hate when people are like, that person's too pretty to have this regular person job. I feel like Margot Robbie would have stuck out in that way.
Amy Adams and Michelle Williams were also both considered.
I could see that. Yeah, let's do an all-lady spotlight reboot with just... Wow. Yeah, I would take... Yeah.
That was sort of a weird, passive, mean comment to Amy Adams. Like, Margot Robbie is too beautiful. She would stand out. Amy Adams and Michelle Williams. Yeah, they could do it.
I love Amy Adams. Give her all the Oscars she hasn't won.
Matt Damon was considered for the role of Michael Resendiz.
Don't you think that Damon and Affleck are on board for, like, they at least get a call for all the Boston movies?
Hope so. Like, it's in the legislation.
Like,
of
they
Boston.
Haven't lived there in 30 years, and it's like, ah, get Damon.
In the deal memo to agree to film in Boston and get tax credits. Damon and Affleck get first right of refusal for all roles. Yeah. Jimmy LeBlanc, who plays Patrick McSorley, who's the victim I believe Ruffalo meets with in the lawyer's office, was himself an actual survivor of the clerical abuse scandal.
Wow.
So when McCarthy first brought him in for rehearsals with Ruffalo, Michael Keaton, and Stanley Tucci, he was concerned that revisiting Jimmy's abusive past might be too emotionally traumatic for him. After the session, McCarthy accompanied him out and asked if he was freaked out by his first acting experience with the other actors. And he replied, of course I'm freaked out. That was the Hulk and Batman and the guy from The Devil Wears Prada. So that's fun.
Batman. People forget about Batman, Michael Keaton. There's a whole scene in Neighbors about it.
Isn't he going to be in The Flash
I don't
as Batman
know.
Again?
I don't know.
Pretty sure.
As Batman? Like, oh, Flash TV show?
No, they're going to have him be like old Batman.
Oh, God. I hate
in
it
The Flash.
All. I don't know.
The Flash is going to be a Batman
Honestly,
movie.
I'm like starting to lean toward movie theaters being closed forever because of this shit.
At least two times, Mr. Resendiz. Now I'm into goofs and errors. At least two times, Mr. Resendiz can be seen drinking a bottle of New England style IPA.
Ah.
That kind of beer was not produced before the start of the 2010s.
Huh.
There's some beer trivia for our friend Becky Dingwall. During the cab ride, after Michael Resendiz pays for copies of the sealed documents, he tells the driver to take Dorchester Avenue and stay off I-93. The cab is never seen on Dorchester Avenue and hits I-93 south. If we were from Boston, I bet that would have made us furious when we watched it.
It's like, doesn't it just drive away? I think it just drives away. Get a life, Boston
same.
Commenter.
When I was watching that Polaroid movie, that horror movie that was shot here,
yeah.
It took like 4 years to come out, and there are scenes where like the character gets on her bike in front of
a on
store
Agricola
on Agricola Street,
and then
like
Dartmouth.
Suddenly she's in Dartmouth, yeah. And it's like, no.
There's some Jesse Stone chase scenes that are like that.
That make no congruent sense. Oh, Jesse Stone. We should review all those.
Yeah, Tom Selleck mini special.
Yeah. Ben Bradley jokingly claims to be the Archbishop of Canterbury when Mike is spooked and asks who is at the door. The Archbishop of Canterbury is the head of the Church of England and would likely have little interest in protecting the reputation of the Catholic Church.
Okay, thank you, religion nerds.
Last one. It's labeled as a character error. I do not agree. In one scene, Walter Robinson's fly is down when he steps out of his office.
Whoops.
Again, along with the fashion, It would be a running joke between Allison and I where we would, like, text each other when one of us realized that we had spent, like, half the day with our fly downs having attended meetings or interviews or whatever.
You forget.
You're focused on other things.
Yeah.
Haircuts.
Your pants are on, aren't they?
Whether the milk is cold. Yeah, the pants are on. We're just trying to come up with a lead and get the paper heads. Anyway. Yeah, that's it for trivia.
Wow. Well, an all-timer. An all-timer of a movie.
Yeah.
Like, not even just journalism movies, just movies. It's a terrific adult drama. Those are so rare.
I remember people saying that, like, it only won Best Picture because it split the vote. And maybe it did, but it's still a great movie. It deserved... This is no Crash or Dances with Wolves or anything. Like, it deserves to be Best Picture.
Agreed. Yeah. And, you know, this is the type of movie that doesn't get made anymore. They tend to cost, you know, $20 million, which is a lot to you or I, but to movies is a stupid budget. It's like a movie's just like $1 million or $200 million. And, you know, they tend not to be big money makers. And so no one aims at that demographic of, I don't know, people in their 30s to 50s.
Not to get back on the superhero thing, but do you think if theaters are done or won't be coming back for a bit, that it will be safer to invest in lower level stuff rather than a $500 million
for sure
Star Wars spectacular? Like, let's just make something that's $10 million that we can guarantee will be recouped on our streaming platform.
Any idiot that's on Twitter right now being like, I think it's great theaters are closed because I can eat what I want at home and I can pee when I want and I can talk when I want. It's like, you are never going to replicate the theatrical experience in your house unless you are rich, and you're not going to do it. It's never going to be as good. And yeah, all this stupid shit that you can't follow with a fucking 50-foot screen in front of you. I'm sorry. How is that going to go for you on your, you know, iPad? It's not going to be great. So yeah, I do think that smaller things that cost less, and then the promo budget is like, I think that's a really good model, actually.
Influencer interviews.
It's you know, this is sort of a dire note to end on for the year, but it's been a dire year. I actually am very concerned about this movie theater closing business. Like, I've seen sort of conspiracy theory leaning stories by reputable places that are like, this is what Amazon and Disney and all the streaming places want. They want to kill theatrical. And I can't believe that people are that cynical. I really can't. And listen, I'm mad at the movies every time I go. People do talk through it. They do kick your chair. They do leave, you know, garbage on the ground. But I'm sorry, the sound and the picture, the immersion, you're never, ever, ever going to get that at home. You're just not. So, I don't know. It's an event. It's not lying on your side and being like, oh, I don't know, I'm pressing spacebar. Like, it's very valuable, and I hope that this death knell that is being rung for movie theaters is wrong.
Mm. Same. So we can all pile in Kyle's car again.
Yes. Let us go back to Harvey's. Smuggle it in. We did it, Jacob.
Yeah, we made it to 30 weeks, 30 episodes, and the end of the year, and a holiday. Not special, but a holiday episode. So as we alluded to, you're very busy in the new year. Do you want to talk about what you have coming up?
It's going to sound like bragging, but it's just like how everything
worked out. This is the place to brag.
Yeah.
You got to get used to self-promotion.
Yeah, you're right. I'm directing my first feature, and that's supposed to happen in April. That's what we keep saying. It's supposed to happen. Really, you know, Nova Scotia is in its second wave, but it's gone pretty well. I am in that system as of January, essentially, and shooting in April. And I should be writing a book right now. So... I just want to also say, in case you think it sounds glamorous and exciting, neither of these things pay a living wage. I do have a nice amount flagged for me in the film budget, but historically, the director fees get deferred and put back into the movie because the budget's really is low. So Don't be like, oh, next she'll be beaming in from Milan. Nope, I'll be in this same apartment until I die.
Oh, maybe. Maybe not. We'll see. You might be in Milan, Monaco, somewhere. Some tax shelter.
Yeah, I'll be in Bermuda or Switzerland.
Yeah, so we're going to take a little break from the show. Maybe think about format. Maybe have some guest hosts.
I would love for you to guest host with some people. That'd be nice instead of hearing me.
I don't think we're gonna stop because we like these movies and it's fun.
So. And there's, as you said last week, you've got 150 on your list and this is only 30.
Yeah. So this would be what, season 1 of 5?
Yeah, buddy.
By season 8, we're just reviewing. Maybe they'll have made some more journalism movies, but maybe we're just on any episode of a TV show where a reporter shows up.
The newsroom or
the product recall episode of The Office. Which is good.
It is a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. So thanks to everybody who listened to this fun little experiment.
Yes, thanks so much.
Where we just wanted to chat with each other.
Yeah, this is really just an excuse for us to stay connected as friends. And make people listen to it.
Thanks to Kim Hart McNeil, H.G. Watson, Katie Toth, Becky Dingwell, Lisa Tozzi, Allison Lang, Allison Saunders. Those were all the guests we had.
We didn't get Stephanie Johns on here. Oh, my goodness.
We didn't.
We will. Nor did we get season 2. We have to.
Kayla Jefford Moore, my friend up here. Grace Sedgers, I think is her name. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing that wrong. Grace, who we tentatively agreed to talk to about Venom, and we never worked that out. Oh, yeah. But we will someday. And thanks to Collective, the film, and the Romania Film Institute for apparently liking our comments about the movie last week. Thanks to Judd Apatow, who retweeted us for some reason.
Yeah, buddy.
Sorry for what we said about Trainwreck.
Judd Apatow retweeted us, and it resulted in 0 additional listeners. So that is why I am not a successful person, because I do not know how anything works.
To be fair, I don't think I would, if Judd Apatow was like, listen to this podcast, I would say thanks, and I would not do that. So anyway.
And thank you, Jacob. I think people could tell if they thought about it, but you do all the research. You come up with the format and the questions. I just watch the movie. I usually complain about like co-watching or paying for it or something. Like I just come and show up with my opinions, which I think is quite obvious if you really think about it.
Well, that to me is the most important part of this.
You also did this for our last podcast, 25 for 25. And you run the show.
Tara, I like taking on additional work for no money. That's why I'm in journalism.
There you go.
Yeah. Take care. Merry Christmas to all the listeners and to you. And I'll see you in the new year, buddy.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone. Until we see each other again, we'll just say stay between the lines.
There you go.
Bye. Merry Christmas.
Bye.